Liberation becomes insignificant and rare, very rarely attained, and Yeah, he said that already. Auspicious. Yeah. And transcendental pleasure, condensed, very intense bliss. And attracts Krishna. Yeah. So these are special qualities which are not manifested in mukti or any other process. And they partially manifest, for instance, one gets ananda from Brahman also, but this is sandarananda. It's very condensed bliss. It's a different type of bliss. And one may get also relief from distress by other methods. But through devotional service, it becomes a permanent thing, whereas in other methods, it's temporary. So, after discussing that, then we are on to sadhana, bhakti, which is the second part, second wave, so to speak, sadhana bhakti. And what's the definition of sadhana bhakti? What was the particular? And so it's that part of bhakti which leads to bhava, which is a genuine realization and experience of Krishna, a direct experience of Krishna. So it's that process which leads to that, the beginning of, let's say, direct realization of Krishna by engaging our senses and mind. And it is something which is eternal. That bhava is something eternal. It's not artificially produced. It's something which is there forever, and it manifests within the heart of the jiva through the process of sadhana. So sadhana is activities we do which somehow allow that bhava to manifest, that genuine experience of the love of Krishna to manifest, by which we can actually perceive Krishna and serve Him. So that's what sadhana bhakti is. So there's two types of sadhana bhakti. One is called Vaidhi bhakti and one is called Raghunuga bhakti. They're both sadhanas. Raghunuga bhakti, we may think it's so high, but actually it's only a sadhana to attain bhava. It is not bhava. It is not real experience of Krishna. It is a sadhana to get there also. And Vaidhi is the other sadhana. So Vaidhi means to follow rules and regulations to in one's practice. One falls under the control of Shastra. And we have three types of devotee in Vaidhi Bhakti. There's an Uttama, a Madhyam, and a Kanishta. Usually we think Uttama Bhakti is someone very, very high up there. But this Uttama here is within Vaidhi Bhakti. There's a definition. So we shouldn't confuse the two definitions, because they're quite different. So we have a Kanishta Bhakta, who is described as having Komala Shraddha, or tender faith. And then we have a Madhyam Adhikari, who is described as having better faith, steady faith. And then we have a Uttama Adhikari, who is described as having deep faith. And all this faith is in terms of Shastra. Because the basic definition of Vaidhi Bhakti is we have Shraddha as our qualification, and that faith is faith in Shastra. So according to the faith in Shastra, then we get three types of devotees. So the one who has Komala Shraddha, or very tender faith in Shastra, he also has little knowledge of Shastra. Some knowledge, but very little knowledge of Shastra, or scripture. And therefore, when other people talk to him about other things, opposing views, etc., he can actually lose his faith in Shastra and go away for some time. Usually he'll come back, but because he has no knowledge, therefore he'll waver. And therefore it's called Komala Shraddha, which means weak faith. So someone can oppose him and defeat him, and then he can change his views. So that is the Komala Shraddha. The one who is a Madhyama is in a better position. He does not know so much, but he knows to the extent that he will not be swayed my opposing arguments. He cannot defeat, but even if he is defeated himself, he will not change his view. So his knowledge of Shastra and faith in Shastra is enough that he will not change his ideas, even if he is defeated. But his knowledge is not so sufficient. So he's called Shastra Adishu Anipuna. He's not very skillful at Shastra. But Shradavan, his faith is strong enough that he's not swayed away. And the Uttama is a person who's Shastra Yukta Chanipuna. He's very, very skillful and knowledgeable of Shastra and of Yukti. Yukti here means, in one sense, logic. But Jiva Goswami says this does not mean word jugglery and material logic. It means to use Shastra in a reasonable way to explain things, to make sense of things. So he can connect the different Shastric statements in a reasonable way, and he can convince other people. And he has Prauda Shraddha, which is very, very deep faith. So he knows Shastra or scripture quite thoroughly. He has very great faith in that. And he can use it nicely and present it to others. So therefore he can defeat others also. And he does not get defeated. So he's called Uttama Adhikari. So all of these three are within the Vaidhi Bhakti. They're not pure devotees. They are in Sadhana Bhakti and Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. So the classification is according to depth of knowledge of Shastra. The Kanishtha has very little, Madhyam has more, and the Uttama has most knowledge of Shastra. And according to that, then we can see their faith is deeper, according to their knowledge of Shastra, and steadiness is more, and their ability to preach also is more. The Uttama is a better preacher, steady faith, etc. And the Kanishtha is very little knowledge of Shastra and very weak faith. And Madhyam is intermediate. So these are the three types of devotees. They are called Adhikaris or Adhikarita. Different qualifications of faith. Other things other than faith are not qualifications. That is, rather, they're disqualifications. practice of jnana and karma. They are not qualifications for taking to the process of Vaidhi Bhakti. In fact, they are detrimental to the process of bhakti. So simply by having practiced jnana for a while, that is not a prerequisite to bhakti in any way. It's not a qualification for bhakti. And doing karma also, following the rules and regulations of karma and karma kanda, that also is not a qualification for bhakti. They don't produce bhakti, nor do they qualify one for bhakti. It is faith. Faith in Shastra. In the directions of the Supreme Lord, to follow the process of bhakti. That is the qualification. So it's independent of karma and jnana, and then bhakti and mukti. So therefore, Rupa Goswami says, as long as bhakti and mukti sit in the heart like a witch, and they haunt you like that, there's no possibility of practicing bhakti. So these are detrimental things, not qualifications for bhakti. Bhakti and mukti, jnana and karma. Rupa Goswami spends he gives a lot of quotations to show how this desire for mukti and mukti itself are actually got nothing to do with bhakti, and how the devotees actually reject mukti. And he's given about, I think, 20 verses like that. Takes up one whole chapter in Nectar of Devotion, just negating the idea of mukti. Quoting from Bhagavatam and other Shastras. So that is not a qualification for devotional service. And Varnashram is also not a qualification. If one is high in the Varnashram system, that does not make you a better devotee or a better qualified person. If one is a Brahmin, doesn't mean you're going to be a better devotee. And even if you're not in the Varnashram system, that does not disqualify you from bhakti. So being in the Varnashram system, that doesn't qualify you for devotional service. So those who are not in the Varnashram system, they can also participate in devotional service. And we cannot judge the grade of devotee depending on, you know, what varna he's in, what ashram he's in. It's independent of that. So therefore, the qualification of bhakti is faith and none of these other things. The faith is not dependent upon varna, ashram, bhakti or mukti or anything else. That faith is independent. And its cause is mercy of Krishna, mercy of devotees. That's all. And that can manifest in anybody. If one is a devotee of the Lord, then he is not obliged. If he's qualified for bhakti, he has faith, and he's practicing bhakti, then he is not obliged to follow lower qualifications, that is karma or jnana. He does not have to follow the rules and regulations of those systems, because he is more highly qualified. So he follows the rules of bhakti, and he is not required to follow the lower systems. So there's no fault on the part of the devotee if he neglects to perform karmas, which are regularly done by other people. Generally, if one does not follow karma, one is considered sinful. If you don't do this type of activity, then you go to hell for so many lifetimes, and all these things in karma. But if one practices devotional service, if he doesn't do those things, there's no bad result. So that's why Krishna says at the end of Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Dharma Paritacha. You give up all of the dharmas and simply surrender. There's no sin. Aham Tom Sarva Papa Moksha Samya. I free you from all the sin, whatever sin is incurred by not doing those things. I will free you from that. So if one takes to the process of devotional service, then he's free of the obligations of other karmas and other dharmas. He doesn't have to do those things. Yeah? So in this way, bhakti is superior. And the qualification is faith. None of these other systems, they're not a qualification for bhakti. Then Rupa Goswami goes on to the angas of devotional service. Anga means the different ways in which we can utilize the body for and the mind for service to the Supreme Lord. So he gives 64 basic definitions, are the types of bhakti, how you can engage yourself. Of these 64 items, of course, 5 are repeated twice at the end. And before the main items, he has 20 items in the beginning. And these are called the door to bhakti. The door to bhakti, like a door, the entrance to bhakti, the first 20. So these are prerequisites of entering into performing the other items. The other items are like deity worship, hearing and chanting, and living in the holy dham, associating with devotees, etc. But before that, you have the first 20 items of devotional service. If the first 20 are not practiced, then one cannot practice the other ones. So one has to go through the first 20. And in the first 20, there's 2 divisions, that is positive and negative. The first 10 are what you do, and the second 10 are what you don't do. And after you observe these, then you can perform the other items. That is the other 44 items of devotional service. And of these, then Rupa Goswami says that first he gives a list of all the 64 items, and then there's many chapters dedicated to giving quotations from different shastras for each item of the 64 items. So that takes up quite a lot of space in the nectar devotion. For instance, there's kirtan. So then you get a verse from shastra glorifying kirtan. Or archana. Then you get a verse defining archana and giving glorification of archana. So each item of the 64 items is got verses to support it from Shastra. Of all the items, then Rupa Goswami says actually the first 3 are the most important. So the first one is to take shelter of the lotus feet of the Guru. Second one is to receive shiksha and diksha, initiation and teachings from the spiritual master. And the third is to serve spiritual master. He says these are the most important. Why? It's because it is through the guru that you learn how to do everything else. In other words, we have to learn how to hear and chant, remember, and do whatever we're doing. So then it comes through the guru. So those are the first three have to do with guru. Taking shelter of the guru means one should approach in a humble manner. This is we have in Bhagavad Gita, the verse Tadadi Pranipati. Pranipat means to fall down in front of the guru. Pranipat. Dipat pat means to fall. So pranipat means to fall down. Be submissive. So one should take shelter of the guru. That is one principle. First principle. Second one is diksha and shiksha. So we could of course say, why not just put it all in one? But he separated them purposely to show that one should have that humble attitude. First of all, that qualifies one for everything else. And then one takes diksha, shiksha, adi, he says, etc. So one gets many things from the spiritual master. But diksha means, what is the definition of diksha? Anyone know? There's several definitions, but that's an interesting topic. Anyone give a definition of diksha? Anyone have diksha? They don't know what it is.
Taking instruction.
Oh, that's shiksha. Anyone know? There's a famous definition there for diksha.
Having connection with something.
Exactly. One definition, famous definition, is the bestowal of Divya Gyanam and the destruction of sin. That's taken from the word diksha. Dih for Divya Gyanam, ksha for kshaya, papasya kshaya, or destruction of sin. So bestowal of knowledge and destruction of sin. Which sounds very similar to Kleshagni and Suvada also. Diksha means an esoteric way to get a bestowal of knowledge and to have sins curbed or destroyed. Jiva Goswami in the Bhakti Sandarbha, he elaborates that a little and he says, therefore, because there's another verse that comes after that, and he says that the Divya Gyanam is contained in the mantra that is given by the guru at the time of Diksha. So Divya Gyanam can be given independent of Diksha also, obviously. Anyone that teaches spiritual knowledge can also give you that. Shiksha Guru can also give you Divya Gyanam. So the Divya Gyanam given at Diksha is that given through the mantra that the guru gives the disciple. And in the mantra is obviously Krishna. So one develops a relationship with Krishna through the mantra. So that knowledge is given. So that's one definition, to bestow knowledge and to eradicate sin. And the other definition, of course, of diksha is that is pancha samskar. One gets five purifications, purificatory rites, which are tilak, or Urva Pundra, and what's called tapa. That literally means to get burned. In traditional Vaishnava circles, they get some metal shankha and chakra and they put it in the fire and they brand you. That's called tapa. North India generally don't do that. They still do it in South India, the Vaishnavas. North India they don't do now. But in substitute of that, you can take wooden things and dip it in chandan and stick it on yourself. Names of Hari. So that's tapa. And third is nama. One gets a name, like Vishnu Das or Krishna Das or Madhusudan Das. So one gets a diksha name. And the most important is mantra. One gets mantra from the guru, a Krishna mantra. So this mantra is a secret mantra. It is not that you chant it publicly. It is given by the guru to the disciple and you chant it silently. And this is used in deity worship.
deity worship.
And the last item is yaga, or worship of the deity. So that getting the mantra entitles you to the deity worship. So these five things are called mantra samskara. Five things. So that's they constitute pancharatrika diksha. So therefore, diksha means to get sambandha gyan through the mantra, basically. And of course, in this this second point, the first is to surrender to Guru, approach and surrender to Guru. Second is to receive shiksha and diksha. So not only diksha, not only we get the mantra and the right to worship the deity, we also get shiksha, we also get teachings. So teachings of what? That is sambandha abhidhya prayojana. I get the philosophical teachings of who is Krishna and who is jiva, what is material nature, and how we, what is our relationship with Krishna, what is our relationship with matter, etc. And we get the knowledge of the process of bhakti, how to execute bhakti properly, what is bhakti, definition of bhakti, and how to execute it properly, that is abhijaya. And we get the goal clearly defined to us, what we're headed for, what is our ultimate, the goal of our sadhana, that is defined clearly to us. So that is shiksha. And that's also given by Guru. Of course, shiksha dikshadi, that could be through the dikshas given by Diksha Guru. Shiksha can be given by Diksha Guru, or it can be given by Shiksha Guru also. Other devotees can do that. Yeah. So this is considered, that's point number two, that's the second anga of bhakti, to receive shiksha dikshadi. Adi, he doesn't elaborate what the adi means, etc., but it could be training of all sorts, as well as this elaboration of shiksha, I suppose. And third, of course, is to save, to serve with enthusiasm and respect, to serve the Guru. In other words, we follow the order of Guru, follow his instructions. So, Rupa Goswami says these are the three most important ones. Because it's through this process that one will perform the other items properly. So, the fourth item is to follow after the sadhus, which means to follow after the previous acharyas and the shastras. And if we don't follow, of course, then it becomes an obstacle to bhakti. So we have to follow after guru, we have to follow after sadhu, previous acharyas. That's also an important item. So these are all interesting items. And then, okay.
Following the previous acharyas, I know one devotee, I know a god brother. He told me that personally it's unfeeling. He doesn't even like it if someone sings Jagannatha but in a different tune than Srila Prabhupada used to sing. So then he told us that attitude. Whereas there are other standards. So how do we know what is the standard?
Oh, well, when we talk about here, if it's related to acharyas following the acharyas, this is a little bit different. It's not just a acharya means those people who have quite a lot of authority within the sampradaya. So in other words, guru is teaching, and then guru teaches, his teachings are based upon acharyas, that is very prominent persons in the sampradaya, like Vishnu Chakravarti or Balde Vijayabhushan or Jiva Goswami. These are acharyas. So those main things we follow. Details may be there with individuals of personal likes and dislikes or whatever, and it's bound to be there. Bhakti Siddhanta has his personal likes and dislikes, and Bhakti Noda has their, everyone has their personal likes and dislikes. Well, those are details. And but when we talk about following acharyas, we mean those main things. And in relation to that, Rupa Goswami quotes that famous verse, Sruti Smriti Puranadi Pancharatra Vinamdana Aikanti Harer Bhakti Upataya Vakalpate, that bhakti becomes creates an obstacle, or it becomes full of obstacles if it is not according to the Shruti, Smriti, Purana, and Pancharatra. So we follow the Shastras as they are explained by the Acharyas. Well, details may be there, small details may be there for individuals, but the main principles following the Acharyas should be there also.
Srila Prabhupada enacted, or he adhered to certain principles, and he adapted for certain principles for the Sankirtan mission. So, what do we adhere to as followers in this company? Do we adhere to his principles?
Well, we have to see what are the principles and what are the details. That we'll have to see. Because we'll see even Prabhupada change some things according to time and place and whatever. So those would be details, whereas other things are principles. So then we have to see what the main principles are and then see what the details are. And the details may be adjustable, the principles should not change. That's what we have to distinguish.
Prabhupada, you find this line, the difference between
Yeah, so that we have to really be careful sometimes. To do that, probably we'll have to see the previous acharyas also. So that's why we can't separate one from the other, guru, from shastra, from sadhu. They all have to kind of fall in line. Then we know it's a principle, and that's there. And the details, of course, there may be differences there. So those are the things, details. But the main things which are all in line, those will be the principles where they all fall in line. They all agree. We will find, of course, that sometimes even the acharyas may have disagreements in one sense. Like Vishnu Chakravarti has a commentary in the Bhagavad Gita, and Valdev Vidusana has a commentary in Bhagavad Gita also. And they have different commentaries, obviously. So they'll make different comments about the same verse, and one will say it means this, the other will say it means that. So in that case, what do we do? Who are we to follow? Does it mean this or does it mean that? And they may give two different meanings to the same verse. Or to a whole section of verses also, they can interpret it differently. Sides on the issue, So what we can see is in many cases that it's one can have, that we can't say one is wrong, because there's different ways in which you can, the same text can have two meanings which are in harmony with the rest of the work. So both can be right, actually. And we can say that even Krishna arranges things in such a way that you can get several layers of meaning, and none are wrong also. Therefore we can... So then we can say that both are right, and neither is wrong. So we should not think they're contradictory in that way. Anyway, all these items are there, these different items. The first 10, of course, the second 10 are considered to be the door to bhakti. And they help us perform the other items properly. So the first three were concerning guru, the fourth ones follow the acharyas, follow in the footsteps of the sadhus, the previous acharyas, follow after them. And then there's other items as well, such as observing the fast days, like Akadasis, etc., living in the holy dhams, and respecting the aswata and the banyan tree, aswata tree, the brahmanas, the cows, etc. And to live according to one's needs, not taking too much and not taking too little. In other words, one should not do undue austerities, nor should one engage in unnecessary opulence. So live according to what's necessary for one's maintaining oneself. There's another rule. So in this way, there's we have 10 basic rules here to follow. And then he gives 10 things you shouldn't do. The first of which is one should not associate with materialistic people, asat people, which is like the opposite of the first three, to take shelter of guru and to follow the sadhus. That's the opposite of that is to asat sangha. So one should avoid asat sangha. And one should avoid also one should avoid making many disciples. That is another one. One should avoid reading too many shastras. That is another one. And one should avoid big projects. That is another one. And there's a quote from Bhagavatam to support that also. So one should not make many disciples. The comment on that is that Jiva Goswami as well, if you don't make disciples, it won't be a sampradaya. So what does this mean? So making many disciples means don't make too many disciples, because that can detract one, and one can get into puja, pratishta, and lab through that. In other words, one can become attracted to wealth, followers, and distinction, etc. So it's kind of dangerous. So one should be careful of that. The other point, of course, is that one should be qualified to make disciples. And the other point is that the disciples should be qualified persons. One should not make disciples just to make disciples. They should be qualified people. So the guru should be qualified and the disciple should be qualified. So therefore it is allowed. One can make disciples, but the conditions are there. And concerning too many shastras, one should not study too many shastras or too many books, etc., which have nothing to do with devotional service. And secondly, one should not study shastra in order to make a professional living out of it. This is common in India, where they study the Bhagavatam and then they make a living out of reciting Bhagavatam. And so that's also not good. To study shastras with the idea to defeat other people and simply carry out argumentation, and also is not considered good. Or to study many shastras but not study them deeply. So that's also not good. So therefore one should not study so many shastras. And projects. One should not involve in big projects. And the reason for that is that if one is unqualified for such a thing, then one will become distracted from one's worship of the Lord by becoming involved in all these big projects. So then, of course, there's a qualification for that. Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives an explanation. He says that one should be qualified in several ways. One should have enough manpower. One should have enough finances. One should have enough lifespan. One should have enough knowledge and enough equipment to do it. If these things come easily, okay, do it. But if it's a great struggle, all these things, then better not to do these things. In other words, if we do things which are too difficult for us, materially speaking, then we get very distracted and very disturbed. So better we just hear and chant in that case. Any questions?
So are these points details or the principles?
Well, he's made the principles here, the first 20, which are necessary in order to follow the other.
So should we qualify? Obviously qualify. But I know myself, we have to be a different God, but I'm certainly not qualified. How can it be?
What is that?
I certainly was not qualified.
Oh. Well, he's the judge. He is the judge. And he made a lot of disciples too. But we have to take him as a judge, not us.
That's the difficulty. When you start trying to distinguish.
Yeah. But the principle is there that if one, of course, one makes many disciples who are unqualified, then that's a burden for the spiritual master also.
But we can extrapolate from that, and we see that, okay, we don't understand Sri Prabhupada's divine sign. Therefore, how can we think we understand any of the other points?
That's true. So actually, then we cannot actually interpret anything of what the spiritual master does. And say he did it because of this or that. We cannot really, we cannot interpret at all, actually. We just have to accept what happened. That's all.
What is the significance of
worshiping the Aspada tree? The comment on that is that because Aspada is respected in the Shastra, for instance, we have in the Bhagavad Gita that is, you know, glorified in some way. Aspata is for, that's the pipal tree, It's a pipal tree, that's Vishnu's tree, actually. It's Vishnu's tree. The banyan tree is actually different from the Aspata, that's Shiva's tree. So Aspata actually is representative of Vishnu and Bhagavad Gita is glorifying the trees on the Aspata tree. So it has some special significance for that reason. Of course, it mentions in the verse to support that Tulsi also is there. And Tulsi, Aswata, cows, Brahmanas, Vaishnavas, and Datri tree. That's the Amaki tree, actually. Also.
You said somewhere earlier on, Shraddha basically was causeless, such as Krishna, gay or not gay, whether you've been born with it or you're not born with it, like a birth of mine.
No, actually, Shraddha arises over a long period of many births, and it arises by getting the mercy, birth after birth, of the devotees, that they engage you in devotional service without your knowing it. In other words, you may hear the holy name, you may get prasadam, you may look at a book, you may see a picture of Krishna, you may hear the holy name or read the name a few times in your lifetime, so these little things help. Influence the soul to get that Shraddha. And it takes many lifetimes. Basically, it's the mercy of the devotee, which is a manifestation of Krishna's mercy over many lifetimes. It's called a Gyata Sukriti. Then these points, the other points, there's many other points, like don't disrespect the devatas. That's among the first 20 also. And don't disturb other living entities also. It's another one. Don't cause unnecessary disturbance to other living entities. Don't tolerate blasphemy of Krishna or his devotees. One should not tolerate that. One should not hear blasphemy. One should not commit aparads against Krishna, save aparads, or against the holy name, nam aparads. One should not be afflicted by lamentation, etc. One should not be miserly in dealings with others. So in other words, one should not be oneself disturbed in any situation. And in relation to others also, one should not create a disturbance. So these are all within the first 20 rules and regulations. So if one observes these, then one can perform the other angas properly. So therefore they're quite important. Because if one is always disturbed by soka, lamentation, etc., then the hearing and chanting and everything else will not go properly. So therefore they're called the door to bhakti. After that, then Rupa Goswami explains the other 44 items. So basically he divides it according to senses. So the first section deals with the whole body. We can't go into detail because we don't have time to cover all the different angas, but the first ones deal with the body, such as putting tilak on and wearing garlands and putting mala on, and then bowing down to the deity, standing up when the deities come, following after the procession of the deities, doing parikramas, dancing. These are all whole body engagements. And then he has, for the voice, that is singing, or Gita, singing songs, and then kirtan, sankirtan, which is loudly chanting together, which may be in different forms, nam kirtan, that is chanting only names, chanting qualities of the Lord, or Lila Kirtan, chanting the pastimes of the Lord, different types of kirtan are there. And then reciting stotras and things like that, praises of the Lord, verses from Shastra, praising the Lord, is another item. So in this way we have prayers, offering prayers to the Lord, prayers of humility, prayers of longing, prayers of aspiration for the Lord, another item. And then taste, taking the prasad of the Lord, taking the charanamrita of the Lord, for taste. Smell, smelling the incense or the flowers or the garlands, etc., offered to the Lord. Touch, touching the feet of lotus feet of the Lord, if one is qualified to do so. Sight, seeing the deity, or seeing the aarti of the deity, or festivals related to the deity, that is sight. Hearing, of course, shravanam, hearing the name of the Lord, qualities of the Lord, pastimes of the Lord, again, shravanam. And mind, then he has other detailed ones concerning the mind, like meditation, jhana, meditating on the name of the Lord, the form of the Lord, qualities of the Lord, lila of the Lord. That's also meditation. And some mixed items also after that. At the end, then he mentions the five most powerful items, which are to serve the deity with great devotion, to relish the Srimad Bhagavatam, to associate with advanced devotees, to sankirtan, and to live in the holy dham. These are considered to be the five most powerful items, which can quickly lead one from sadhana to bhava. In relation to that, he actually mentions them twice, and then he quotes a verse for each one. His own verse, he makes his own verse. All these, he gives a verses from Shastra to glorify and explain each item. And at the end, to re-glorify the items, the five items, then he gives his own verses to glorify them. And there's a famous one for the deity. And in that one, it's the form of the verse in Sanskrit is such that he criticizes. It's a criticism, but through the criticism he glorifies the Lord by saying that if you want to indulge in social affairs and family life and enjoy nicely in this material world, then you shouldn't go to Keshigat and look at the form of Krishna, who is standing there in a threefold bending form with his flute in his knight's mouth and his long bewitching eyes and his peacock feather in his head. So don't go to Keshigat and look at Supreme Lord Govinda if you're interested in your social affairs and things like that. Don't do that. So in this way, by criticism, he glorifies the great attraction one should have for the Supreme Lord. And how, if one looks upon the Supreme Lord and worships the form of the Lord, then one will definitely develop a disinterest in material affairs. And another one is Bhagavatam. He glorifies the Bhagavatam also by saying, oh, you're a great fool, because now that you listen to Bhagavatam, you've given up your interest in karma and gan and all these other things. You're a big fool. Don't listen to the syllables of Bhagavatam. So this way he gives a nice glorification of each of the five principal elements there. So these five angas of bhakti have an inconceivable power, a chintya shakti, to manifest as bhava in the heart of the jiva. And to manifest not only bhava, but Krishna himself, who is the object of the love of the bhava. So all of these items are there, and they can be done together, or they can be done individually also, in combination. And some of the angas, like archana, include many things within them. So we engage many of the senses in archana also. Archana will include many other angas, like in worshipping the deity, one's seeing the deity, one is saying things to praise the deity, one is offering obeisance to the deity. So some angas have many angas within them also. And other angas can be done separately, like kirtan can be done separately from everything else. And of course he gives examples of personalities who did one anga and got perfection. Like Sukadeva Goswami was chanting kirtan, and Parikshita was hearing, and Prahlad was remembering Smaranam, and Sakyam, of course Arjuna, Dasyam, Hanuman, Aminavedanam, Bali, Archanam was what? Pritu. Archanam. Thus, serving the lotus feet, Lakshmi, like this. So one can do one item and get perfection, or one can do many items, like Ambarish, who did all items and got perfection. So, but the five items are considered the important ones for us to follow. And if you follow these five items, they're very powerful for us. Some items, Rupa Goswami says, in the verses, if we read the verses supporting the Shastric verses, sometimes they sound a little materialistic. They give rewards, the material rewards, like going to Svargaloka or whatever. So this is the praise is given there for the more materialistic persons. Actually, they give devotion. This is the highest thing, but some of the Puranas will speak in terms to encourage the materialistic persons. But ultimately, all of these items are leading us in devotional service to the position of from sadhana to bhava. So some things are not angas of devotional service. The practices of varnashram dharma are not angas of devotional service. Many people do many things in varnashram, different duties they follow. These are not parts of bhakti. They're not angas of devotional service. And jnana and vairagya are not angas of bhakti. They're not also things we cultivate within bhakti. They make the heart very dry. In bhava, the heart becomes soft, and in prema, the heart becomes liquid. Because completely melted in relation to Krishna. But through jnana and vairagya, that does not take place. Rather, the heart becomes dry instead. So, in other words, that devotion to Krishna is not developed through jnana and vairagya, rather it stops. Devotion does not take place. So therefore jnana and vairagya are not angas of bhakti either. And good qualities also, cultivating good qualities, which is part of varnashram, morality, etc., that also is not an anga of bhakti. Of course, that doesn't mean we cultivate bad qualities either. But the good qualities naturally manifest through cultivation and devotional service. That is, we get the sadguna, or the good qualities manifesting as part of subhada and devotional service. So they automatically manifest. But we're not trying to artificially cultivate these things separately. Nevertheless, we have to follow certain rules and regulations to prevent, you know, excessive displays of anger, greed, etc. So we do have some strictures. One other point he makes in this part on Vaidhi Bhakti is that we follow the process of Yukta Vairagya rather than Phagu Vairagya. Vairagya, of course, he said it was no good. We reject Vairagya as such. But we do have some sense of renunciation also. But it's always in relation to Krishna. We're not simply rejecting things, but rather we engage things in Krishna's service. This is our type of Vairagya. So we don't reject things outright. This is what the aspirers for liberation do. They reject everything in the material world. But the devotee doesn't reject, rather he tries to engage everything he has in Krishna's service somehow or other. And that's called Yukta Vairagya. And just as when Lord Chaitanya took sannyas, then he quoted a verse from Bhagavatam. And that verse is expressing that. This is a prayer to the of the Avanti Brahmana. So in that prayer he says that Real renunciation is that not that we give things up, but we give everything to Krishna. That is real renunciation. So that is what Yukta Vairagya is. We must become detached from material things. But the process is not just to give everything up, but rather, let us give everything to Krishna. Well, this is Yukta Vairagya. And this way we become detached from everything. So that ends the section. That's still part of the same, this sadhana bhakti wave has two parts, the vaidhi bhakti and the raga nuga. But this is the section on, completes the section on vaidhi bhakti.
How literal though is it to take these benedictions given after devotion? Uh-huh. So I'm just reading, if one has once bowed down before the deity, they don't come back to this material world.
Prabhupada gives an explanation there also that some of these they give very high results for that activity. So Prabhupada says we should not think these are exaggerations. It happens, but it's not going to happen in all cases immediately. That's all. But nevertheless, any type of bhakti is very powerful, so it can do that. Mm-hmm. So we see in Bhagavatam also, simply chanting the name of the Lord once is enough to deliver you from all your sinful reactions. Mm-hmm. We have statements like this also. We see in the case of Ajamil, he chanted not even with faith, without any faith, accidentally he chanted, and he was, all of his sins of his lifetime were wiped out. So that he didn't get the hellish punishments from the Yamadutas. So of course many of the results we can't even perceive. we can't see the immediate results. We don't see the destruction of our karmas or anything happening like that. That can also happen. But it may not be so sudden. Maybe it may take place more gradually. But then we do have examples where it does take place suddenly also in some rare cases. So the power of devotional service is very great, and it can do all these things. But it may not happen in all cases, and it may not happen immediately either.
So the practical process of giving away to Krishna rather than rejecting, does that essentially mean that we understand that everything belongs to Krishna?
Yeah. If not ours. In other words, in the material world, we're thinking, I have a right to enjoy, and that therefore this belongs to me, so I can enjoy it. And devotional service is nothing belongs to me. I'm not the enjoyer. Everything belongs to Krishna. It's for his enjoyment.
Even if you're deprived, or as we're called.
Yeah. So when Krishna becomes the center of enjoyment, we offer everything to him, not to ourselves.
In the introduction to Bhagavad Gita, the story of the Nirvasa, the man who was constantly thinking of his lover and his wife, actually. But essentially, people were seeing him as a very interesting person, but she. And because her meditation was in her loved one, the analogy was Krishna, the man would be materialistic, apparently.
Maharaj, in the name of being humble, would you say it's a fine line between exploitation and being humble? I mean, if a devotee is trying to be humble, but what's the chance that maybe then there can be exploitation from other people?
Isn't that question come up the other day? Yeah, I think so. Being humble doesn't mean to be exploited, but in relation to Krishna and in relation to our own situation, when there are unavoidable things, we use our intelligence as much as we can in this material world. But in some cases, we fall into positions which cannot be helped. So therefore, we simply take that as the mercy of the Supreme Lord in that case, and we accept that position. That we've done all we can to prevent an unfortunate thing happening, but it happens anyway. Then we simply have to accept that as the Lord's mercy and understand that in the past we've done activities which have created the situation as a karma for us due to our past sinful activities, and we cannot blame others for that position. But within this lifetime itself, we do have intelligence, so we can avoid many things in this lifetime due to our intelligence and common sense and our efforts, etc. So we don't purposely put ourselves in a miserable position also.
for material things in any field, of utilizing things, then it requires a lot of training over a long period of time to utilize things or assets or resources or anything to achieve any particular goal. But although Yukra Arahi, the idea sounds very nice and practical and realistic, but to actually perform it properly, it seems it's not such a vague thing. So I read somewhere that Srila Prabhupada wrote that it has to be performed under expert guidance. And I've been thinking about that and how it's not possible to do it on intuition.
Well, the main idea, I think, is this, that in our material consciousness, we like to use things for ourselves. Basically, we take things and we use it for our own enjoyment. And in spiritual life, then, we're following this principle of trying to please Krishna. Anya avilashita shunya anukulyam Krishna nusilanam. We do activities for the pleasure of Krishna, not for ourselves. So that basic definition involves action, and action involves things for the pleasure of Krishna, as long as we have this material body at least. So therefore the definition of devotional service itself is engagement of things of this material world for Krishna's pleasure. Whether it's using words or objects or whatever, and we're using it for Krishna's service. So it may not be constant. We cannot do that constantly in the beginning. In the ultimate stage, of course, that's what's supposed to happen. Using everything, body, mind, and words, 100% for Krishna's service. That's the perfection. In the beginning, it may not be like that. But at least the attempt should be there, and whatever devotional service we are doing, that we should try to do that with whatever we have. But I'm saying it won't be constant in the beginning, so we're not going to offer everything in the beginning. But gradually, we should do that.
Maharaj, could you explain how Krishna uses the devotees as instruments to get out, deliver our karma or our rectification, and how we can not hate each other when we have to deal with each other and we get some result from a devotee? Like a karma, like it's not karma, but it's Krishna's mercy. But can you explain how we cannot feel bitter if a devotee, we're engaged with another devotee and we're getting our karma or we're getting our rectification from Krishna between each other. How we cannot, fall out with being friends with each other.
Well, that is this basic instruction given in Bhagavatam that the real devotee earns the mercy of the Supreme Lord by tolerating his miserable condition, this material world, understanding it at the mercy of Krishna, and continuing to perform his devotional service. So if we're put in a miserable position somehow or other, which may involve other devotees or other people or whatever, and it's unavoidable somehow, we can't do anything about it, then that misery, of course, is simply a reflection of our own state, because that position may not be miserable for somebody else, just due to our condition at that time, anyway. So we should simply understand that I'm in this position because of my past karmas, that's all. And that I can't blame other people. Basically, how I'm acting now, feeling now, is due to my own previous lifetimes and karmas, etc. Now I'm in this state now. So basically, we have to realize that the cause is not anyone else but ourselves. For all of our conditions of this lifetime, we create the conditions through our past activities and our desires, etc.
So if we don't understand that, we could go away and we could become deviated.
Well, generally, if we keep thinking the cause of all of our problems is outside, not in ourselves, and then we just generate more karmas and create more situations like that in the future. The whole purpose of karma is to understand that we are the cause of our own suffering. Not the Supreme Lord, not anyone else. And the cure, therefore, is changing our own attitudes, not to blame other people for it.
The
64 items
of devotion service, is this the section of Abhidhamma?
What, the
64
items?
Yeah. The reason I'm asking is because we've mentioned how Jnana and Vairagya are not part of the Yamaha.
Yeah.
And in the Bhagavad other person, sometimes Srila Prabhupada comments on, because one person could cancel the mental power, even if it abides in one's constitutional position with the impurity in the pure devotional service. Yet in other places, he mentions that Dhyan and Vairagya, when they're related, he's saying to Sambandha Dhyan, those with one's relationship, then they appear to be part of the step-by-step process of bhakti.
Yeah. There's a lot of other words in the definition of bhakti we have that jnana and karma, etc., should not cover bhakti. So some types of knowledge and some types of karma do not cover bhakti, and that's therefore acceptable. So sambandha jnana, that is acceptable. And if we don't have sambandha jnana, then actually we have namabhas. So therefore we're supposed to have sudanam. So sudanam will be created if we have that knowledge. And if we don't, then we have namabhas.
So will this be categorized as abhidhamma, which is the application of that knowledge?
The angas. Yeah. So the guru gives shiksha, he gives sambandha jnana, basically, and how to execute the abhidhamma. And of course, the knowledge of the goal. So sambandha abhidhamma prayojana given by the guru.
So we explain the first three items are important items. Because that's really important, because once you take initiation of the spiritual master, so he can guide us in all other principles that are
The first three are there, and then the other 17 are there, and these act as the door to the other angas, the other 44 angas, or minus 5, of course, because 5 are repeated.
In what sense the 5 important five items are there? Like those 5 are very important. In what sense like those 5 are very important?
Oh, because they can very quickly raise one to the status of bhava. They have the chintya shakti of the Lord to do that.
Anyone of them?
Of course, we know that chanting the holy name is powerful because it's the name. And association, we know, is very important. And to hear the Bhagavatam is very important also. And worshipping the Lord in a deity form is important also. And living in a holy dham. Of course, there's some exceptions made there, because everyone cannot live in the holy dham. So the comment on that is, and by the Acharyas, is that if you cannot live in the holy dham, then you should remember the holy dham.
But if you said that those 64 are condensed into the 9.
Because obviously many of these items of the 64 are included within deity worship and things related to the deity, like seeing the arati of the Lord and taking darshan of the Lord and taking charanamrita and bowing down before the deity like this. Many are expansions like that. And then of course hearing is expanded in so many ways and chanting is expanded in so many items like songs, stotras and all these things also. Yeah, so basically it comes down to not if we can condense them all into lesser items.
And then
Navadita Bhakti.
In the Samadha again, you all know that you are just the eternal spirit soul and the external Krishna, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and you have nothing to do, whatever happens in the material world has nothing to do with in our happiness. So when certain things happen, whether people chastise us or even praise us, actually that is not our source of happiness. Actually, our source of happiness is actually to do these emotional things and please a lot. So is that correct to say that when someone say good things or bad things or anything that started happening to us, whatever the situation, is just that the body going through, or is it the soul going through? What is the situation? Is it the body going through?
Yeah, definitely. It's on the body. The soul is ultimately not connected with any of these things in the material world. It cannot be in any way affected. But due to our identification with the body, the soul's identification with the body, then we suffer.
All the time, because we identify with the body, that's how we suffer.
If we don't identify with the body, then it's not going to make any, won't affect us at all. But due to bodily identification, then we suffer.
But when we do any devotion, is it the body doing or the soul doing?
Ultimately, it comes from the soul. Yeah, the devotional service. In other words, bhava is that's the soul experiencing Krishna. And sadhana bhakti is the process by which that takes place. We engage the body and the mind and the senses. And in that way it takes place. But the impetus to do so comes from the soul. Because the shraddha is coming from the soul, not the mind. Faith. So faith is the cause of devotional service. It's the basis, the qualification. That little faith, that faith comes from the atma, not from the mind. So the impetus for doing all these devotional acts is the faith, which comes from the soul. But we engage the body. And to engaging the body, then the soul develops more and more and more until we can experience Krishna. The soul can experience Krishna.
So initially, it's the soul that falls down from into this material world.
Yes, it's our decision of the soul to enjoy in the material world. And it's his decision to get out also. So the faith is the turning point. We decide we don't want to stay in the material world anymore. And we want to surrender to Krishna. So that faith is the turning point by which we start going out of the material world. Oh, yeah. Sokari. To be controlled by lamentation, etc. And then this is one of the, on the first 20 items, one should avoid being falling under the control of lamentation, etc. So in other words, if we are, what are these caused by? Material attachment. For material attachment, we'll be affected by lamentation, anger, greed, and all these things. So if it's very strong, then it is very difficult to do devotional service. If we're completely attached to the material world, then difficult.
So we should understand that to be soul.
So these things have to be, if it have to be weak. In other words, we can't indulge in these things.
What if someone's lamenting? They says also, tell me that I should have abhorrence, guru abhorrence, Vaishnava. If someone's lamenting that they have committed abhorrence.
For lamenting that we commit abhorrence. Is that a lamentation or not?
Lamentation.
No, I think the lamentation there means lamentation over losses of material assets or something. That's what it means, basically. That we should regret if we commit aparads, definitely, or do have some fault in our devotional service. But then we should correct it also.
What about, as is so common these days, the lamentation or subconscious, meaning maybe a family situation in early life, or something which embeds a kind of subconscious lamentation. Would that be a complication also?
Yeah, definitely.
Just to add on to that, so do we have to constantly remind ourselves that we are just a spiritual and this thing has nothing to do with us all the time, and that we always focus on Krishna in the center?
Well, that's a little difficult to do. It's a little bit philosophical. Probably the better thing to do is to, when we perform our devotional service, is to attempt to serve Krishna without material motives. And by constantly doing that, we develop some sort of link with Krishna. So when we're in difficult situations, we'll think of Krishna instead of being disturbed by the material conditions. Just like when you're in a material condition, some disturbing condition, you're going to have an accident or you're going to die, then you will take comfort in the fact, you will think of somebody, the wife will call out for the husband, the husband will call out for the wife, or the children will call out for the mother and father in that situation. So they take some comfort in that relationship because it's a strong relationship. So we develop a relationship with Krishna, and then any difficult situation, we remember Krishna instead of remembering some material solution or something.
But if you understand that you are the servants of Krishna rather than thinking that you are spiritual and constantly demanding others about.
That's the more positive. Thinking of spirit soul is a medium position, it's like a neutral position, but think you're the servant of Krishna, that's a positive. way of looking at it. And it's easier for us too. Because thinking I'm a spirit soul, I'm not this body, is more or less a negative conception. I'm not the body.
In one of your other lectures, you said that we incarnate with each other, groups of people, families, you know, came together in the last life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you were thinking of some particular person, like your father or something, when you're dying, would that mean you'd reincarnate again?
Could be, yeah. There are examples of that in terms of people that remember their past lifetimes and come back as the grandchildren or something, or born in the same family, because of the strong attachments.
As you said, the manner that I get makes one's heart
dry.
Heart dry.
Yeah.
But the jnana about devotional service, and the attachment, the vairagya, the devotional service, do they also make one hard?
No. Just like in Bhagavatam it says that through the performance of devotional service that the jnana and vairagya automatically develop. So of course we get detachment from material things. That's obvious because we have yukta vairagya, which we give everything to Krishna. So when we become attached to Krishna, we automatically develop detachment for material things for our own enjoyment, because we're giving it to Krishna for His enjoyment. So we do get a vairagya. And jnana, of course, different jnana, we get a realization of Krishna. And by realizing Krishna, we get all knowledge, not just that impersonal jnana. But jnana here, that just becomes, it dries up the heart, we mean this impersonal jnana, basically. I am Brahman, I am not the body, I am the spirit soul. That type of thing will dry up the heart. It doesn't encourage a relationship with Krishna at all.
So much so that it makes it better to say that I'm the spirit soul, I'm not this body.
So I'm a servant of Krishna. Yeah, that's the more positive way of looking at it. And it's also easier. It's easier to have a positive conception than a negative conception. Okay. Okay, and then Hare Krishna.